This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We'll be dealing with quite a profound issue, and that is the whole question of the meaning and handling of suffering, according to the Torah. And what I'm going to ask you to do to begin this process, in fact, is to give a few moments of thought, and then I'm going to ask the three or four volunteers who are willing to share with the group examples of why are you laughing? This is a new start. What can I do? It's a new subject. To share with the group a situation of personal loss, not through death. So we're talking about loss in a business situation, loss in a relationship situation. A person who has suffered personal loss, how you dealt with the self-esteem, with recovering the self-esteem from that blow, from that rejection. So we're looking at loss that entails a rejection, and I'm looking for three or four volunteers to give us very briefly, we don't want a whole sheet from each of the three or four, just very briefly, what mechanisms you used to cope with that loss and come out with self-esteem intact. Okay, so give that a moment's thought, and then let's have a few volunteers.
I had a mentor who was my principal advisor on my doctoral dissertation. We were very close. He taught me a tremendous amount. At one point he said to me, "Al, I'm not having anything to do with you anymore because you're orthodox." And there was a rejection there. But I thought about it and I figured, it's his mission, God. Not me. There's nothing, I'm not involved in any of that. Because I was never orthodox with him. Because at that point, I wasn't that orthodox.
Right.
But more than, you know, just like anybody with one more halakha than you is that.
Okay.
I just figured it wasn't me.
And once you satisfied yourself that the problem wasn't yours, it was his, your self esteem was back inside. Okay, another example. Michael.
One of your brothers, yeah. I felt a big, big loss then it was in Seattle. And I don't think we ever took it personal. I didn't ever take it personally, but since he was my rabbi and he was my leader, he was a Yiddishkeit, it was a tremendous moment of dealing with it. And the resolve of that is
I didn't ask what I did to recover yourself. I asked what have you done to recover your self-esteem? No, it doesn't count. The cost is one. We need another few. Yes.
When I was about 28, I had a lot of success in my businesses. And I went and bought a restaurant. And in a matter of 3 years, I lost all the money I had made, totally lost that confidence, and ended up closing the business. And what I did was I looked back at the lessons I could gain from that experience and that loss, and just dove into something new. And slowly I got myself confidence.
Okay, what is your name?
Karen.
Thanks, Ben, for that one. One more. Did you get out of it? What did you do?
How did I get out of it? never give up. The same knowledge we have that I acquired over 20 years of experience, that I have to do with the knowledge. When we talk to you about the technology, we're going to acquire it and focusing on the way that it's going to be. There's no positive in the way.
Okay, is there another example of a loss of a relationship, an injection in a relationship? Divorce, a breakup, a loss in a business relationship, a partnership, where there's been a...
I'm not going to say when you... the loss is, but I'll say how I got out of it. One time was that I got married and I just gave... I started helping other people. And when you help other people, it's going to feel better.
Okay, let's have a look at the dynamics of loss. Why does it happen, and how do we cope with it? You want to hear about it? Is it relevant to anybody? Starting with the passage in the book of Shmuel that we're learning, which is chapter 18, verse 9. And I have mentioned, and I'll just remind you again as we started the new series, that it will be good for you to read ahead so that you can, having read the passage, the book is a well-known book and available at many bookshops. So it's not difficult to access the text, and because I'm not going to read through every word, I'm going to assume that you've read the coming chapter or chapters. So we're in chapter 18 now, we'll be busy with 18 or 19 this week and next week and next week after, so just keep a chapter ahead. Doesn't matter if you read it only in English. Verse 9, and so eyed David with suspicion from that day on.
The Hebrew
point. By Yishau Oyin es David Mahayom Arulala. David, it doesn't say eyed with suspicion. The correct Hebrew translation is he eyed David from that day onwards. That's a more correct translation. And it was in the next day that a spirit, again in English, is a spirit of melancholy from God, came upon Saul. The Hebrew is Batitzlat Ruach Elohim Ro'o El Shaul, and a spirit of God, a bad one, rested on Shaul. English is melancholy, the Hebrew is a bad spirit of God. And he raved incoherently in the house. Again, the English misses some of the Hebrew subtlety. The Hebrew is Vayitzna Vegetar Habais, which has a double meaning. The normal meaning of that word, the straightforward translation would be, and Saul was prophesying in the house. But the there is a sense that he couldn't have been prophesying if there was this heavy negative spirit in him. It doesn't make sense that he was prophesying. So Vayisnabe has a second meaning, which is talking incoherently, raving incoherently with a certain madness to him. The David Menagin Beyodo Kiyon Beyoin, and David was playing the harp with his hand as he did every day. And it's almost like a familiar scene. There's Saul waving away, and David playing his music as if nothing was going on. It's just two different worlds. And the spear was in Saul's hand. So here's the raving king with a spear in his hand, and David with whom he has a love-hate relationship playing music. Then Saul hurled the spear, saying to himself, I will thrust it through David into the wall. But David eluded him twice. He threw the spear at David to pierce him against the wall. And fortuitously, David just happened to shift his position as the spear was in the air, and the spear missed him. Let's stop there a moment, because that really poses the main problem of this chapter, of this section of the chapter, and that is the spirit of laity from God? Does God make us miserable? That really is the issue. And if it comes from God, then how much responsibility can we take for our own melancholia? How much responsibility can we take for our own depressions? Does a depressive mood come from God? Can a depressive mood come from God? And in this case, did the depressive mood come from God? And this initiates a whole lot of actions. The first is the attempted murder. Two attempts of murder and a succession of attempted murder. In fact, this sets the scene for the rest of this book, of the first book of Samuel, which is the pursuit, the ruthless pursuit of David by Saul. The intent to destroy this great man, Shaul, this great tzaddik, this most righteous personality, just becoming completely enraged with fury about the man he really admires, David. And there's a strange relationship, but to what extent is Shaul responsible for the rage, for the anger, for the jealousy, for the melancholy? And to what extent is this some kind of spirit that God has introduced into him? How responsible are we for our own sanity? And I'm not talking about whether there is genuine clinical insanity. I'm talking about that type of insanity for which there is no real clinical cause. And of course that in itself gets into a whole debate which I don't want to get into. And I'm sure that anybody, if you would have taken Shaul at that moment and analyzed him chemically, you would have found certain chemicals that could be held responsible for his state of rage. But who did the chemicals create the rage, or did the rage create the chemicals? That's the big debate, which isn't even really beginning yet. The only debate that's taking place in scientific circles, as far as I've been able to pick up, is to what extent are there chemicals? To what extent is it chemical? But which is the cause and which is the effect? Could it be that by our behavior we create chemicals in our bodies? It eludes me why that is not the debate. We know very clearly that our behavior creates positive chemicals in our bodies. What are they called? Endorphins and a whole lot of other ones too. If you can do exercise, that creates endorphins. And endorphins put you in a good mood. So why can't you do bad things and that creates bad endorphins that make you do bad things? And just as when somebody's endorphins are going and he's feeling good and he's feeling strong, you say to him, you're lucky, God has made you so energetic. And he says, not lucky, it's not God. I worked out today and I worked out yesterday and I worked out the day before. So we're very quick to take credit for our endorphins. But when we have bad things going on, bad chemicals, we say, it's chemical. You're born with it. You're not prepared to take the responsibility for our chemicals all of a sudden. So it's like parents. When our parents are good, we say, it's us. And when we're messed up, we say, it's our parents. So it is with our chemicals. When we create good chemicals, we say, we did it. When we create bad chemicals, we say, chemicals. This is chemistry. Which is quite interesting. But be that as it may, what we're looking at here is, in certain Shaul's situation, to what extent did God play a part in this melancholy? And it says quite clearly, God built an evil spirit. And that evil spirit is responsible for the decline of the personality. That evil spirit is responsible for the deterioration of one of our finest in history into an enraged man. As we see over here, we begin to lose some respect for this man of such great dignity. Shaul is head and shoulders above everybody in his generation. Shaul had never sinned before he was made king. Shaul, a man of enormous dignity, as we'll see, his own children, his own daughter, can't get used to the parallel or the lack of parallel between David later on when he's king and Shaul. That there was so much dignity in Shaul that even David looked undignified compared to Shaul. And this man of dignity becomes enraged and throws a spear, tries to kill David twice, spends the rest of his days pursuing this man. We start losing respect. What's the cause? Here, at this point in the Tanakh, this is the point of the story where the whole thing changes. And what changes? Batitzlach Ruach Elohim Ro'or El Shol. And arrested in Shol the spirit of God that was bad. Does God do bad things? Does he bring bad spirits? What are these bad spirits? What is this melancholy? What is this depression? That's what we need to understand. In so doing, we have to analyze our responses to hardship, to difficulty, to loss. And they're interesting. Our responses are really interesting. But those responses that are natural and the responses that God expects from us. And they're different. What is the natural response? We have it in the parasha this week, I'll show it. By Yehimi Kets Yomim, it was the end of a period of time. By Yavei Kayim Mipri Ho'adamo Minchol HaShem. But Kayim brought from the fruits of the earth a gift for God, sacrifice. What was it? The Medrash told us it was Zera Pishtan, it was flax, the cheapest, most abundant form of vegetation that he could find, that had any value at all. The Hever, he began to call us to know the Chalbein. Hever also brought a sacrifice, Abel. He brought from the sheep. Cain was a farmer, and Hever was a cattle rearer. But what did he bring? The Chalbein, the oldest, the firstborn of his flock, whom the Chalbein, and from the fattest of all. He brought the prime species, the prime members of his herd. He brought as a sacrifice. So not surprisingly, Vayisho Hashem El Hevel, God accepted Hevel's sacrifice, the El Kayim Ve'El Milchoso Lesho, but to Cain and his sacrifice, God did not listen. Vayichal L'Kayim Le'od, the first example of rejection. You might say Adam being thrown out of the Garden of Eden, but that was clearly his choice. That was clearly an action, the consequences of which he knew would be to be thrown out. But this is different. Here he's bringing a gift. The ultimate of rejection. To bring a gift and be rejected. It's not good enough. That's hard. That's tough. So when I ask for examples of loss, one of the things that one would be looking at, and one of the examples actually gave, that is an advance that was rejected. That's the worst kind of rejection of all. When one puts oneself out there for someone else and is rejected. I would imagine that there's a fraction of that that takes place in the dating area and in the marriage area. Not only in dating, that goes on in relationships. That a person takes risk and puts themselves out for someone else, and that gesture is rejected. First case we have it here, so we've got to study this. This is how we deal with this kind of rejection. Vayichal l'kayim lo'ed. First reaction, anger. Second reaction, vayiplu ponov. Depression. Sadness. It's anger and the sadness. What does he do about it? God intervenes and says a few things there, which we'll come back to in a moment. Cain then says to Hevel his brother, when they're out in the field, and we're not told what he says, this is he spoke to Hevel. And this midrashic background, they have a major theological argument about the justice of God, whether God is just or isn't, whether he does care or he doesn't, whether there's punishment in the world or there isn't. But by Yehibir Yeson Basodo, when they were out in the field, by Yokum Kayin al Hevel Ochiv by Yehavir. So furious, so much fury is there in Kayin's anger and in his depression that he kills him. Very similar case to Shaul. Rejection. Shaul will be rejection, or has been rejected. Anger, depression, murder. Attempted murder in the one case, actual murder in the earlier case. What's the argument all about? The Kleyoko is an interpretation on the Chumash that explains this very beautifully. In terms of Cain saying to Hevel, and he says that's the meaning that was taking place in the field. You, Hevel, will never be an independent thinker. you will never be a contributor, because you're an imitator. The only reason you brought a sacrifice is because you saw me bring a sacrifice. So if you're living in a community, you're okay, because you're copying what everybody else is doing. When everybody does, you're bad. When everybody gives charity, you'll be charity. You'll be a good guy, but you'll never be original. If you're out in the field on your own, you won't be able to stand. You won't know what to do. You won't know how to work out what is right and what is wrong. Nothing will be initiated from within you. Everything that you do is motivated externally. Everything that you do is motivated by outside sources. One of my daughters was commenting on what she thinks is tragic of modern society, she commented on it in a number of different areas, and one sees it, and the comment is valid. The degree of dependence on external resources of energy, entertainment, the inability of our children to entertain themselves, the inability of adults to entertain themselves. There is an assumption that if there's entertainment, you will be entertained in some form. Somebody says, what are you doing this evening? You should be expected to respond. You're going to be going somewhere to do something, to be entertained. The fact that you might be at home reading or studying or talking to your wife or your children, that's not the kind of answer that one expects or that one often gets. One is going somewhere, one is going out to a place where there will be an atmosphere of entertainment, whether it's a movie, or it's the theater, or it's music, or it's a place where there are lots of people, where there's action. There needs to be an outside, an external input. Now, the fact that there sometimes needs to be external input, that's perfectly valid. The importance is total dependence on external input. And what television is simply bringing that external input right into our houses so that we can have it there all the time. And motivational talkers and gurus, these tapes that people listen to over and over again, what is that? I can't even motivate myself. I can't even get myself going. I need someone else to get me moving. And what am I doing? I'm going to work. I'm going to build my business. I'm going to create my future. I need somebody else to tell me every day to do it. Are we that dependent? Yes. Hegel, that's what Kine accuses Hegel of. You will always be dependent on external sources of motivation. You will not have motivation within inside you. You're a 20th century character. And I'll kill you, because there's no place for you. And he feels strongly about that. Kine says, I innovated sacrifice. I created the idea. I started it. Nobody told me to be a sacrifice. I worked it out. And God accepts yours, the copycat. And now we have a situation of the innovator being imitated and the market preferring the imitation. Okay? Modern business, read the newspapers. I didn't want to mention that. also is the accusation that you are not, well, what is the angle? What are people saying? You weren't really the originator, but we love your stuff. The fact is we're buying it. Are you forcing us to buy it or not? Nobody's forcing anybody to buy it. The market loves what's easy and comfortable to use. It doesn't have to be an innovator. The innovator is not necessarily the one that makes the fortune. Says Kine, I am the innovator and you've got the market. God listens to you. A very modern situation. So right there in that very first story of mankind's interaction one with another, we have the most modern sort of interaction. Two competitors, an innovator and an imitator, and the market going for the imitator. What does the innovator do? Kill the competition. Let's get them. Kill the competition. That's what Kine does. The Kleopas says in Vayikra, when we are first introduced to the laws of sacrifice, the words used are Adam ki yakriv michem. When a man wants to bring a sacrifice from himself, it says the Kleopas, first it uses the word Adam, not Ish. A man uses the word Adam, reminding us that the true model of sacrifice was neither Cain nor Abel. Cain was an innovator, but he was a cheapskate. Abel was an imitator, but he was generous at least. And if it's a choice, God chose the generosity. Rather an imitator that improves, and that is abundant and generous, and that feeds, and that gives, and that builds, and that is dynamic, than an initiator who holds on and will not let anybody share it, and there's meaning in every way that can possibly be, that there's no generosity. that the model, the key, is Adam. Adam also brought a sacrifice. Adam brought a sacrifice as a Kayot, the Bais and the Gomorrah, of an animal with one horn, a unicorn. And that one horn, he says, represents the fact that there were no other people. There was no market, there were no competitors, there was no textbook to learn from, there were no MBA courses, there were no motivational speakers. So what got Adam to bring that sacrifice? Innovation. With his own idea. Nobody told him. And was there generosity? Yes, there was. There is a tendency in the innovator to be mean because there's exclusivity, and there is a tendency in the generous one to imitate in order to feed the abundance. The sacrifice is being able to be innovative and generous. To do it from within yourself, and to do it in abundance, to do it generously, to keep on producing, to keep on innovating, to keep ahead. One of the biggest problems with innovators is they rest on their laurels of last year's innovation. It was so brilliant and so clever, and the market went so crazy that they forget to innovate a week later. And you can't do that. If you're an innovator, you've got to be innovating all the time. You can never stop the innovation. The danger of innovation is it leads to complacency. And that's the tightness, that's the meanness. Cain will bring a sacrifice. I don't have to bring a magnificent sacrifice because nobody else in the world knows about sacrifice. So whatever I bring, God will say, great. Wrong, Cain. You bring a sacrifice seconds later. Globalization, information technology all over. How long will it take for half the world, a quarter of the world, to learn your secret? 25% of the world's population learned his secret a moment later. They saw it. And what do? They innovate it. Now what do you do, Cain? You should be a step ahead. And say, okay, they improved on my innovation. Just see what I'm going to do tomorrow. Instead, I'm after the competition. That's the meanness and that's the tightness. When the Torah tells us, bring a sacrifice, it's Adam, Yochri, Mikem. Bring a sacrifice like Adam did. Mikem, from within you. Innovate. Let it be from yours. Don't imitate. When it comes to generosity, don't copy. Generosity is being original. Figuring out your own way of doing it. Figure out your own way of making a contribution. Figuring out your own way of giving a gift. Figuring out your own way of uplifting another person or other people. Do it your way, but do it generously. That's Adam. That's the way Adam did it. We don't follow Hevel's model and we don't follow Cain's model. We follow the model of Adam. God says to Cain, Lama Cholera, why are you angry? The Lama not with Fonecha. And why are you depressed? So whereas in the case of Saul, God is blamed for causing the depression, in the case of Cain, God challenges Cain and says, why are you depressed? What's that? Get out of it. Put yourself together. I'm your motivational guru. Stop being depressed. And he carries on talking to Cain and says to Ophel, which we'll analyze a little bit later, Hello and Tetiv says, Inertative the Pekah Hapas Revet, you can achieve whatever you want to. You don't have to stay where you are. That you can also deteriorate, and that might be your natural inclination, that you could overcome it. We'll analyze that phrase in a moment using a sukkah. What is essential to Cain's response? Cain's response is, I've lost. I innovated. I gave a gift. I made a contribution. I knew it was unique. I knew nobody had ever done this before. I didn't learn it from anybody else. I didn't even learn it from Adam. This is my own idea. So whatever it is, it's better than the competition because there is no competition. Very dangerous when there's no competition. Because when there's no competition, any junk is better than the alternatives. And that's the situation. Cain was in a momentary monopolistic situation created by his own innovativeness. For an innovator sacrifice, there are no other sacrifices. It's not a good one, but it's the only one. Seconds later, Hevel steals the thunder and does it better. What should Cain's response have been? God accepts Hevel's. Now's the moment. I can do nothing about that. My sacrifice was rejected. Hevel's was accepted. What's my issue now? Take it out on Cain, eliminate the competition, or look inward and say, did I slip up? Was mine not good enough? Is the market telling me that there's someone better out there? And what does that do for me? Come back to that question in a moment. I'm going to learn with you a piece of Shari Chu. This is Radhani Yona. He writes about repentance. And he says the following in his second section. When a person encounters suffering, Yoshiv el libo v'yomer, the correct response is, "Ein zeki im deroko u'malelo v'asher osu eilelo." The chataov oyu v'nafshu. The correct response is, "I've done something wrong. There's something I could have done better." Now one has to be careful not to get involved in a spiral of self-criticism and self-destruction. And the process that he's recommending here is one of humility and reconstruction, not one of destruction. So it's not, and we'll discuss the difference in a moment. The tirah b'minhag basar adam, if you compare that to human behavior, God's behavior to a human behavior, ki yechet ha'ish lish, the man sins to his friend, uva'eis tzoroso yischaret, and when he suffers, he has chalotzer, he feels sorry, he regrets it. So somebody does me harm, and he goes over me for years, and then comes his time, and he begins to suffer. And he realizes the suffering is as a result of the very actions that he did to me. And then he comes to me and he says, after 10 years of gloating over me and making my life a misery, he says, I'm sorry. What is my tendency to say? A fine time to be sorry. Now you're sorry. All the years was fine, now you're sorry. Explains why then you're like, God doesn't do that. Never. God says, fantastic, you're sorry, I accept your apology. That's great. And Rabbeinu Yonah suggests that we adopt that attitude with other people too, but we don't get men with people who repenting because things are tight. Because, says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's part of the reason for things getting tight, is to create the change in people. That is what repentance is all about. So the only correct, the only worthwhile response to the suffering is, what can I do to change? I will read a piece of Rambam to you. The Rambam says it is a positive mitzvah, the beginning of the laws of fasting. It is ok ulahariya bechatzitz rost, in those going by, to praying by shouting out, by crying, and blowing trumpets and shofars and things, whenever there is a communal disaster. Why? This is part of repentance. Because when a disaster strikes and we shout and cry about it, Yedu Hakol should be glad. What are we saying? We are declaring publicly that we acknowledge responsibility for the disaster. Something wrong, we've done something somewhere. But if people don't respond by shouting and crying, and the great rebels of the Minag Alimun, they say this is just cycle, these things happen. That's cruel. The Gorenus learned with Amek B'Maseh and Haron has been cruel to yourself because it causes you to cleave to your wrongdoing. It causes you never to break away from that which is causing the tragedy. The Rambam, like Rambam again, is saying, tragedy strikes when mankind, it's not always a tragedy strikes the very end of the day. These are very complex issues and not always easy to analyze. But the broad principle is, tragedy strikes when we've done something wrong. And the first thing is to take responsibility, to realize that, and to seek the opportunity for change. Now, if we understand suffering and tragedy in that way, we can look at one of the prime models of suffering. And there's an amazing section of the Zagon Grudzinski that analyzes pages and pages in the most beautiful, deep, philosophical and psychological analysis of suffering. And he poses some troubling questions. The one question he poses is, the whole question of Egypt. What was that all about? Abram says to God, God says to Abram, you will have a great nation of children. Multitude. happened to the children? Abram says, how do I know? And the children will inherit the land of Israel. And Abram says, how do I know that that will really happen? God says, and how do you know? If you ask such questions, your children will be slaves in Egypt. And we were destined because of that question to go through these horrific years of suffering in Egypt. Explains the Ramban. What was Abram's intention? He wasn't questioning God. What he was saying is, God, Israel is critical to Jewish survival. I need to know that no matter what the Jews do, how low they think at different times in history, they will be able to retain their hold, their rights to Israel. You're not going to take it away from them. Since you do respond to people's choices, and when people make bad choices, you do take things away from them, I want to know that you'll never take this away from us, no matter what. Says God, okay, the Egypt experience, that will be the guarantee. What does that mean? Explains about Ron Brzezinski, not a long while ago, he survived the war. He says, if you look at the Egypt experience, did it bring them to repentance? Did it bring them to change? No. They didn't come out a great nation. They were in a great nation. Before the Egypt experience, they were great people. Jacob, Joseph, the sons, the brothers, their children. A great nation. What were they at the end of all that slavery that God gave us? A nation of slaves, virtual idolaters. God had difficulty almost, so to say, distinguishing them from the Egyptians. God couldn't find mitzvahs that gave them any justification, that gave them any right to redemption. He had to give them two mitzvahs, the sacrificial lamb, the Kohen Pesach, and the Bruce. He gave them those mitzvahs there so they could do something good. There was nothing redeeming about them. That's how low they sunk. So what was the purpose of the suffering of God's languages? If the purpose of pity, of suffering, is to bring about change, this change was negative. So what is God guaranteeing? What's he giving? Why is he putting a nation through all of this? Says about the university, it wasn't altogether negative. It's true, they dropped to the lowest levels. But then something happened. They witnessed miracles. They saw the 10 plagues. They saw the sea split. They saw the Egyptians suffering through their ups and downs. They saw manna, they saw the river, some wonderful miracles. What happened as a result of that? 49 days later, they were on a level of prophecy sufficient to receive the Torah at Sinai. The Egyptians saw those same miracles. The Jews saw nothing that the Egyptians didn't see. And what changed in the Egyptians? Nothing. Explains about Leon Grudzinski, the suffering of slavery opened the possibility to respond to miracles in a way that they couldn't have responded had they not suffered. The way people who don't suffer respond to miracles is the Egyptian way. No response. The way people who suffer respond to miracles was the Jewish way. 39 days and you're ready for Sinai. That's the response. And that makes unbelievable sense. Somebody explained to me this week that people who've been on cocaine can, for years later, not recover the capacity to find ecstasy. By ecstasy, I mean just ordinary ecstasy, not the tablet. Do not recover the ability to find ecstasy in day-to-day events. They've been on such highs through the drug that nothing can compare. So they lose the capacity to celebrate natural ecstasy. And that makes a lot of sense, of course. Take the reverse. A person who has suffered terribly, he's on the reverse of cocaine, he must be heightened. His capacity for ecstasy must be heightened. That's what suffering is. Suffering is the opposite of cocaine. Now we think cocaine gives an uplift, but it doesn't. Cocaine denies you the opportunity to ever feel uplifted without cocaine. Suffering creates in you the capacity to be uplifted by a flower, to be uplifted by a bird, to be uplifted by a sunset. That's what suffering gives the capacity to do. People who went through the concentration camps, when they came out, the way they related and still relate today to life is a way that none of us can possibly relate to life. Can't do it. There are all sorts of negatives too they come out with, but the ability to relate to some of the little things that we take for granted. One of the areas that certainly we thought in South Africa was when President Mandela was released from 27 years in jail. And somebody writes about his autobiography, which is an interesting book to read. How this man, still today, is able to enjoy simple things in life with such celebration, and it's an infectious celebration. He transformed the nation with that celebration, with that joy of life, that joy of people, that joy of freedom, but we couldn't really relate to it. We just saw it on his face, but we'd never experienced it. You have to go through 27 years of suffering to get that, or it's easier to get it if you've been through 27 years of suffering. Now, getting into God's mind, so to say, if that's why God makes us suffer, for two reasons: either to effect change, or to create in us the capacity to celebrate miracles. What is the means of escaping suffering? If one wants to avoid suffering, what do we need to do? We need to find the capacity to do it without that. Let us have a look for a moment at loss. A person is at a minimum, let's say financially, at a minimum, no income. And he doesn't really value his money, appreciate his money. It's okay. He takes it for granted. He was raised that way, he was born that way, his parents were that way, his grandparents were that way. So it's absolutely normal. He loses his money. All of a sudden, money takes on a new meaning. Regains his money. His money, he relates to his money very differently to the way he used to before. What about that same person, if he were to look at his potential income and say, in potential, if I really work hard, I could be earning $100,000, I could be earning $1 million. And he visualizes that in potential, he knows he could do it. Then what is he experiencing when he looks at his $100,000 paycheck? He's experiencing loss. I have lost my potential. Not fair, I better go after it, but this year I've lost it. I only got $100,000 this year, I could have got $1 million. And he pursues the million. He doesn't need to lose his $100,000 to learn the value, because he's learned the value of loss through experiencing loss in potential rather than in action. And you follow what I'm saying? There is a potential future value, and if you can see the future value as real and look at the present and measure the gap as a negative, that's motivation. Then you can go for it. If you're complacent, if you don't see future value, then you see present value as future value. Then you get it. Then there is no motivation. Then you need to pay other people to come and motivate you and say, hey, get up, do it, do it, because you can't see it for yourself. It's the same in all areas of life. If a person can visualize the potential of what he could be, he doesn't need loss to value what he's got, because he's dealing with loss every day of his life. So there are two types of loss. There is the loss we can impose upon ourselves by virtue of the gap between actual and potential. Or there is the loss we can experience through the gap between the past and the present. In other words, the negative is the other way. I used to have 100,000, now I've only got 10,000. There is loss. The only person who's in real trouble is the one who has no loss at all, because he has no sense of value, there's no movement at all. So if we can develop the ability to value our potential and to feel deprived if we don't make it, then we are experiencing loss without God having to give it to us. And that loss is positive, because it drives us onto new things. If we can experience the miracle of the sunrise without having had to lose the ability to see one, if we can experience the potential of what a relationship can be without having to go through loneliness and loss in order to value it, then we don't have to go through that loneliness and loss. So when God puts us into a situation of suffering, he's doing so. In most cases, suffering is a complex issue, and I don't want to oversimplify it by trying to explain God and suffering in a mouth. But at least to give us some kind of opening into it, God introduces us to loss when we have lost our own capacity to experience the value of loss ourselves. Now, what does that mean? What are we then meant to do? What should Cain have done? Cain brings a sacrifice. Sacrifice rejected. What's his response? I could have made it. I could have done it like Abel. And I didn't. What an idiot I am. I feel like killing myself. That would have been okay. It's not that he didn't actually do it. I'm not suggesting suicide. But there's a very big difference between being suicidal and committing suicide. Nothing wrong with feeling suicidal occasionally. It's quite good. As long as you don't do it. Nothing wrong with feeling a little suicidal. What are you saying if you're a little suicidal? I'm disappointed in myself. I didn't do it. I haven't made it. Now comes the critical thing. So what do? You do a K, a K and kill? Or do you do a change? And say, I didn't make it. But tomorrow I will. This is never going to happen again. I'm never going to be caught with that kind of complacency. I will innovate better than Abel. I will innovate in a way that Abel, of course he'll copy me again the next day. But when he wakes up and realizes where I am, I'm going to be way ahead yet again. And does that mean I'm number one for the rest of my life? Yes, and that's life. Pursuing that potential and feeling intensely disappointed any day I don't make it. Any day that I... And I read to you the Suprema on what God says to Cain. Listen to it carefully. Why are you depressed? God says to him. Here's the explanation. Ki kashuyesh lekilku ezu takon. When a rishon of a caliber, of any caliber, but particularly a caliber of the Suprema, makes a comment, number one, it's authentic. It's tradition, it's been handed down through generations. It's measured word for word, letter for letter, to be accurate and impactful. For when there is a loss, when to a destructiveness or a loss, there is ezu takon, some kind of correction possible. En roim lehitzta'er al ma she'ovo. It is improper to feel upset about the past. Not allowed to. Avarei lishtadel lahasit tikkun lo'asit. All your energy has to be to correct the future. So what you've got to decide is this correctable or not? Is there something to learn from here or isn't there? Can I change or can't I change? If I can change out of this and create a future where this past event won't be repeated, I'm over it. It's finished. It's gone. It is immoral, it is improper, he says, to feel pain over a past loss that can be rectified. Rectify doesn't mean that you recover the loss, it just means you learn from it and make sure it doesn't happen again. You correct yourself. And that's what God says to Cain. What are you depressed about? Depression brings inactivity. That's why I said suicidal is better than depression. And suicidal sometimes gets you to action. Not so different than suicide action, but suicidal is energy in suicidal. Suicidal means you could kill yourself. That's drastic. That means you're willing to do drastic things. Well, there are lots of things you can do that aren't as drastic as killing yourself. So try them first. But depression, you don't feel like doing anything. Depression, you want to go to sleep. Depression, there's no great basis for depression. If you want to wallow in your own misery, be suicidal if it's not depressing. And in the sense of being willing to act, do something about it. Do what? Look at it and say, this is me. This is not Hevel. I'm the problem. And that means if one has it in a market situation, you innovate an idea, the market doesn't buy it. Somebody else steals your idea, the market loves it. What do? Eliminate the competition? No. What was wrong in the way I did it? Was there something wrong in the innovation? Was there something wrong with the price? Was there something wrong with the marketing? Was there something wrong with my attitude? Was there something wrong with the attitude of my salespeople? Where did I do wrong? Fix it. There's a reason. The market is saying something to you. It's very easy to say the market's jealous. It's very easy to say the market's this, the market's that. At the end of the day, God is sending you a message, not the market. God is talking to you. And he's saying, just not good enough. And you choosing to focus all your anger on some outside source and lose all the energy of God's communication. And what does it mean if an employee is expecting a large bonus and he gets a small bonus? He can say, my manager's an antecedent. He can say that. And he can feel good. It's not me. He can say, he doesn't like me. That's fine. He can say he's a nasty person. I don't know. I wouldn't even want a bonus from him. All great, fine. Makes you feel comfortable. Does it bring about growth and change? No. But this one says, suffering is God talking. Suffering, I'm talking about this particular type of suffering, the suffering of rejection, which is one of the most painful of all, emotionally painful. The suffering of rejection is God saying, you just aren't good enough. Figure out where and fix it. And sometimes we can figure out, and sometimes it's more difficult, sometimes we can't. But that's the message. And even if that isn't the message, there can be no harm in assuming that is the message. There can be a great lot of harm in assuming all sorts of other messages. But if you assume that's the message, even if it isn't, you grow. You benefit. And in some of the hard areas of life, areas back to the question of dating, relationships, very easy to say, you know, he didn't phone me again, he's an idiot. He doesn't know what's good. I know, I'm okay. And what should I be upset about that for? It's very easy to say that, and it might be true, but you're missing an opportunity for growth. Is there anything I could have done different? Is there anything I should have done different? The least you can say is, if he's such an idiot, why didn't I agree to go out with him? I don't know you in trouble. And likewise, her, and him with her. And these things are situations of every area of human reaction that entails risk and rejection. There is the tendency, the Cain phenomenon is the natural tendency. It's him. It's the competition. He's an idiot. He's no good. The hardest thing is the humility to be able to say, this is a message from God saying, you're just not good enough. Get going. Do something about it. Fix it. With that, let's have one more look at Saul. Saul has made his mistake already. He's wiped out the Amalekites. He didn't wipe out the Amalekites properly. God was furious with him. God said, I'm taking your kingdom away from you. I'm going to give it to somebody better than you. There's nothing Saul can do to change that anymore. That's done. Saul has lost the kingdom. Does Saul have any choices left? Now he sees this youngster David coming in and just having success after success after success. David is popular. David is courageous. David is charismatic. The men like David, the women like David, the soldiers like David, even the enemies admire David. David can do what nobody else can do. Saul is deteriorating, losing his kingdom, and in front of his eyes, this young boy, with no assets, no wealth, poor, is just growing in stature every day. What does Saul choose to do? The key is in verse 9, not in verse 10. Vayehi Shaul Oyein Es David. And Shaul eyed David. You remember we had the shear on the iron harap. He eyed David meanly. Now very interestingly, if you look in the Tanakh at the Hebrew, those of you who can follow the Hebrew in verse 9, Vayehi Shaul Oyein is spelt with a vav, Oven, which means Avon, sin. Oyein means a sieve with an examining eye. And Avon is sin. And what is the sense of this? Since sin lies in the way you look at others when you are rejected. If you are Oyein, if you really analyze, Oyein means to study it in depth. If you study the issue in depth, that's Oyein, you'll come out great. But if you look at the other one, that's Oyein, you've chosen to sin. And that's his only choice. From here God takes over. The melancholy now comes from God. But what causes that? Your choice. The way you're looking at David. You're using the Cain mechanism in your relationship to David. You're choosing not to say, what have I done wrong and how can I repair it? Let's look at the other scenario. Let's say Shaul would have used the Sukuma's route, the Rambam's route, the Rabbeinu Yonah's route. If Shaul would have used the appropriate route, and he would have said, I can't get my kingdom back. It's gone. My son will not have the kingdom. In fact, it appears that David is going to be my successor. That's what it appears. What can I do with the rest of my life? Repentance, self-improvement, won't get me the kingdom back. But imagine what a hero. He wouldn't be pathetic. One of the worst things is to be pathetic. And the biggest cause of, I'm saying to say patheticness because it's not pathos. Pathos has a positive tone to it. I'm talking about being pathetic. The essence of being pathetic is seeking the fault in others. That's the most pathetic thing one can possibly do. It's the competition, it's the market, it's circumstances, it's my wife, it's my husband, it's my boyfriend, it's my rabbi, it's my synagogue, it's the media, it's everything. It's always something. It's never me. That is pathetic. That is the essence of being pathetic. And by Shaul focusing all of his anger and attention on David, we have one of the greatest people in our tradition becoming one of the most pathetic characters of the Bible. Shaul, in front of our eyes, we watch dignity melt into patheticness, into being pathetic. And what does it? Or yearning, or vain instead of anger, to look with sin, to look with anger and with jealousy. That's somebody who's not the cause of anything. David didn't cause you to make a mistake with the Amalekites. David didn't cause you to disobey Shmuel. David didn't cause any of that. He wasn't around. You did it all by yourself. David is the man God has put in your place because you messed up. That's why he's there. You didn't mess up because of David. David is there because you messed up. It's that way around. It's like the chemicals. The chemicals didn't make you mad. Your madness gave you chemicals. And now it's chemical. Now it's God gave you melancholy. But where did that come from? A chemical in your brain. Sure, this is chemical. If he would have been examined at the moment he was throwing that spear, any psychiatrist would have found Shaul insane. But who caused the insanity? And he showed awareness, David. His choice to place the blame on David introduced such envy and anger inside him that it started generating the chemicals. It started burning inside him. We choose how we want to respond. We can't choose our circumstances. That God gives us. But how we respond to circumstances, only we choose. That's the essence of free choice. Free choice is not I have the real freedoms to make major choices. I couldn't choose my parents, so my whole genetic makeup is not my choice. My whole environmental makeup as a child was not my choice. The schools I went to, all the things that really shape who I am, were not my choice. So how many choices do I really have? Our circumstance? Very little. God designs my circumstance. But I'm absolutely free to respond to that circumstance any way I choose. And I can respond to loss and to suffering by finding the scapegoat, and then I go mad with anger and envy. Or I can choose to respond to loss by seeking within myself the things I can change that would make me never suffer that loss again. And that would be critical. And that's the story of Shaul that we'll begin to track. The story of a great man who loses something of that greatness. The story of a dignified man that loses some of his dignity. Not because of the original sin he committed. For that he's punished. That doesn't lose him dignity. That loses him opportunity, but not dignity. His loss of dignity is because of his response to that punishment. Blaming it on David instead of taking responsibility for it himself. Seeking to remove the source of what he perceives, the source of competition, rather than to drive the innovation within himself, rather than to drive the greatness within himself. Had Shaul simply made that choice and said, I will never recover my kingdom, but I can recover my dignity by being that person, he would have made it. If you look back at my opening remarks and the way people responded, it was quite interesting because the responses came out, and this, if we would have done it throughout the room, we probably would have got people coming up with different responses and at different times in their lives. Some people saying, I looked at it, the situation, and I said, you know, it's not my problem, it's him. And I felt okay. And other people saying, I looked at the situation and I said, what can I do to change? How can I make sure that this doesn't happen again? What can I learn from this? And there's times in our lives where we naturally tend the one way and times when we naturally tend the other way. And even if the one way is true, even if the fact is that the problem is really his or hers, not mine, there's no growth in that approach. And it's always necessary for us to take a self-changing approach of suffering is an opportunity to listen to God. Suffering is an opportunity to look at myself and say, I'm suffering for one of two reasons in terms of this discussion. There are other reasons too, but in terms of this discussion, I'm suffering for one of two reasons. Either I'm failing to value what I could be and to pursue what I could be.
or I'm failing to celebrate the joys and the special moments of life. And for that there needs to be loss. If I can rectify that, if I can recover the capacity to celebrate life without having to experience loss, if I can recover the ability to feel the suffering of not achieving potential, I will not have to feel the suffering of losing actual. If I can make that move forward, that move into a future, that expansion and stretching of myself, then my suffering will be the suffering you experience in a gym, rather the suffering you experience in a hospital. They're both pretty painful, but in one case it's suffering I'm choosing because I'm developing myself. In the other one, it's suffering that is imposed on me because there's something wrong with me. Two different kinds of suffering. And to some degree, we can master that and we can make the choices. We can't escape the pain because change means pain. Our choice is only are we going to go to the gym tomorrow, or God forbid, are we going to wait until something painful happens to us that we would rather not. Each one of us, in our choices to exercise ourselves and expand ourselves, will, with the help of God, escape some of the suffering that inevitably happens, and at least where there has been suffering, take the lessons of that suffering and grow exponentially into beings that can not only cope with that suffering and put it behind them, but avoid any such suffering and find happiness and well-being in the future. Thank you.